Hello, welcome back to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This is the fastest trip possible around the entire universe. Seriously, we pretty much explore more or less every single aspect of the galaxy, and we get you back in about half an hour. My name's Dan, thanks for giving us a listen. This week, we'll look at the most amazingly named dinosaur ever. We'll also talk about squirrels and how they can defend themselves. And we've got a way that you can design a robot to explore space for us. That's on the way. Plus, I will answer some of your questions. As always, today, they're about tears, cats, and hot air balloons. So if any of those ring a bell, if you remember asking me a question about that, stay there. I might say hello in just a sec. First, let's get a lesson from the smartest school outside of the solar system. This is with Professor Pulsar.
Deep Space High, destination Mars.
Jump into your wormhole and travel to Deep Space High. The school is space. But hurry, because lessons are about to begin.
So, gang, we've been thinking about the challenges presented by the terrain and environment on Mars and how it affects the design for robots that are being sent from Earth. Who can remember what we've learned so far?
Well, the materials used on a rover have to be able to cope with extreme temperatures. Mars gets very cold.
Brilliant. Anyone else?
They also have to cope with dust storms, which can smother solar arrays and get into the equipment.
You have to be tough to be a Mars rover, don't you? So today, we're thinking about another design challenge. I'll give you a clue. It's to do with the mission objective. I wonder who can remember that.
Is it to locate the famous Martian water world and skate park?
Well, one of the objectives are to find out if there are any signs of life on Mars. Is that close?
Very close indeed. Now, if a robot is on Mars looking for the tiniest piece of life or organic material, what's something that could go wrong? Imagine if someone sneezed onto the equipment, and when the ExoMars rover arrived on Mars, its probes discovered traces of the sneeze cells. People might jump to the wrong conclusions, that there was life on Mars, and that they also suffered from colds.
I suppose even the tiniest particles of organic material from Earth could get trapped on the rover and be taken all the way on the mission.
That would give the scientists very confusing results.
That's why every single piece of equipment on the ExoMars rover has to be completely sterile and clean of any organic material. Even everyday materials can't be used, like rubber for tyres and certain oils. They're organic materials and contain traces of living organisms from Earth. Every bit of plastic, every drop of paint, any lubricant used must be totally synthetic.
I suppose it's also a good thing to make sure the rover is clean, because if bacteria or germs did get onto Mars, well, it could kill off whatever life was there to start with.
Can you imagine that news story? We're excited to announce that we've found life on Mars. But unfortunately, a snotty tissue from Earth got stuck on the ExoMars rover and the common cold has killed off all the Martian life.
It sounds funny, but it's absolutely true. We don't want to contaminate Mars with germs or organic materials that could cause harm. So let's see how they tackle those challenges in the lab. As you can see, the laboratory where the ExoMars rover is built is a very clean and sterile environment. Technicians have to wear a full bodysuit, face mask and hairnets too. They're not allowed to touch the rover with bare hands. This is to prevent any human matter coming into contact with it. Before the rover can leave for Mars, technicians will have to sterilise it, so every component on it has to be either baked out, which is what it sounds like, basically put in an oven and baked for a very long time to kill off everything, or bombarded with hydrogen peroxide plasma, a hot bleach gas, which isn't very nice if you're a living organism.
But if you heat up a circuit board or a delicate piece of machinery or blast it with chemicals, won't that damage it?
You're right. It just shows how tough every last piece of the rover has to be, even before it's got to Mars.
Well, no one said space exploration was easy. Certainly not if you're an ExoMars rover.
Deep Space High, destination Mars. With support from the UK Space Agency. Find out more at funkidslive.com/space.
Right, let's get some of your questions answered on the show then. Remember, if you've got anything sciencey that you want me to figure out for you, you just need to leave it as a review for the Fun Kids Science Weekly over on Apple Podcasts. That's what Barnaby has done. Hey, Barnaby. You are 10 and a half. The half is very important, of course. Barnaby wants to know how and why tears are made when we're sad. Well, tears are made in the lacrimal glands of your eyes. And actually, you're crying all the time. Just tinily, so small you can't even notice. You weep something called basal tears, and they help keep your eyes clean and keep the dirt away. In fact, you go through about 200 millilitres of tears every single day. Now, scientists, though, they're not exactly sure why we cry when we're sad. They think that maybe it's evolutionary. Maybe you cry when you're sad to get sympathy from other people, or maybe you cry when other people are sad to let them know that you're on their side. They do know, though, that the lacrimal gland is partially controlled by the area of your brain called the limbic system, and that deals with emotions. So there is a connection there. Maybe that's why we cry when we're happy too. And also scientists have found that tears do contain some hormones which act as a painkiller and calm you down. So there's kind of a lot of things, but we don't really know the exact reason yet, Barnaby, but thanks for the question. This is from Sam Fu over on Apple Podcasts, who is 9. And a half. Again, that's important. Cheers, Sam. He asks, why do cats land on their feet? Now, they don't always land on their feet, Sam, but more or less they do. It's because of something called the writing reflex. Inside their ear, in fact, I think inside our human ears too, they've got like a little sensor, a chemical, which helps keep them balanced. It helps them figure out when they're the wrong way up. And when the cat works out that it is upside down with this thing in its ear, it swivels its head around very quickly, and then their body naturally follows and they'll straighten. Now, cat skeletons are amazing as well. It really helps out with this one. They've got no collarbone. They've got a backbone with 30 vertebrae in there, which means they're just insanely flexible, and that helps them land straight on their feet, but maybe a little bit precariously. Thank you for that, Sam. And lastly, we got a nice and easy one to end from PJ Jansen, who asks, how do hot air balloons work? Well, PJ, it's because the flame that heats the hot air balloon gives off loads of hot air. And one of the fundamentals of science is that hot air rises because it's less dense and lighter than the cold air around it. So that cold air sinks. It has to move the lighter hot air out of the way, so it pushes it upwards, which is what makes the hot air balloons go into the sky. Thank you so much for the question. If you've got something sciencey that you want answered on the show, you need to leave it as a review for me over on the Apple Podcast Store. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This week, we're talking about a national school robot competition. Twinkle and the UK RAS launched it the other day to get us ready for UK Robotics Week, which is happening later on this year. They want you to design space robots using a specially created app. And to tell us more, we have one of the UK's leading experts in robotics, Dr. James Law, on the phone. Hey, James.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, I'm really well. Thank you so much for joining us. I want to start with one of your job titles, if that's okay.
Okay, yeah.
You are the Director of Innovation at Sheffield Robotics.
Yes.
What does being a Director of Innovation mean?
So my role is really, part of my role is about looking at how we take robots, which are in our research labs, the really exciting new types of robots we're developing, and how we get those out into the real world. So how we work with industrial partners and hospitals and schools to make sure that the research that we're developing gets out into the real world for people to use.
And robots and robotics, how it's used every day isn't how it was prophetized to be used, you know, back in the day in old science fiction movies, these massive robots that would come taking over the world. But robotics is a lot more subtle than that day to day, isn't it, James? Can you just tell us a bit more about how we do use robots in society?
Yeah, sure. So for a long time, as you say, you know, there's been these prophecies of what robots might do in the future and these kind of visions of big human-like robots, big metallic machines that are capable of kind of thought and all kinds of complex actions. And in reality, we haven't got there. We're a long way from that kind of thing. And so in the real world, most robots that people might recognize have been in things like car manufacturing plants, where they've been building your cars. But over the last kind of 5 or 10 years, we started to see a shift away from that, with robots getting more capable within the labs and being used in a wider variety of settings. So, for example, I think the most populous type of robot at the moment is actually the robot vacuum cleaner that some people have in their homes.
They call it the Roomba or something like that. It bounces around, doesn't it? It's low to the ground. As a director of innovation, James, how much say do you have in what robot we're going to design next?
Personally, I don't have a huge input over the influence over the direction of robotics. But what we do instead is we look out to see what the applications for robotics might be in society. And we actually take that influence from society, from the general population. We like people to input into the research that we're doing to ensure that we are making the types of robots that people will want to use and will actually need, rather than just trying to guess ourselves. But what we also do is look at how the interesting science that is being undertaken in universities can be applied to robotics. So as well as having a mind in mind where robotics could be used, we also have to look at what the exciting developments are and how they could be turned into robotics for the future.
Well, let's talk about the future of robotics very quickly. I would imagine if you saw a graph over how much we have learned about robotics in just the last two decades, I mean, it goes up and up and up. It's rising at an almost exponential rate. But what don't we know about robotics yet? Do scientists have any clue over perhaps what we might find out about what they can do and how we can use them in the future? Do we know what's in that grey area yet?
So I think one of the really big challenges is also one of the barriers for robots being able to do kind of the really exciting things which have been forecast in science fiction, is how robots understand their environments and learn about them in similar ways to humans so that they can adapt over time. We haven't cracked that yet. We talk a lot about artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence has been used in different ways to mean different things in the past. And the thing that a lot of people are really interested in now is this idea of general artificial intelligence, which is the idea that robots and machines could learn over time on their own without training, just through interactions with their environment and interactions with people, and how they could learn new things to enable them to do all the types of things that humans can do.
Are we hoping that robots are going to learn an emotional intelligence as well?
Yeah, so some people are, yes. And I think there is a big ethical question about how we develop robots and what they should and shouldn't be able to do, and also how they represent themselves to us. So we know there are fears about robots maybe trying to manipulate people. But in fact, what we want to do is ensure that the robots are being developed in a way that they are transparent. So we always understand what they're doing and understand how they're thinking to ensure that they are making the right kinds of decisions and doing the right kinds of things.
I don't know if you remember in the news, I can't remember the specific details, but in the news a year or so ago, there was a story from Asia, I think, where two robots on a computer had started talking to themselves in a language that they made up. Do you vaguely remember this story?
Yes, I have a vague recollection of this, yes.
Well, just as a scientist who works on robotics, how could that type of thing happen? How can robots develop their own language to chat to each other?
It was hyped up a lot in the media to be more than it actually was.
Oh.
We can program robots and artificial intelligences to learn things. I can't say for absolute certain, but I think in that particular situation, the robots, rather than learning from their environments and learning from other people, they were learning from each other. And so although it seemed like they had developed their own language, they were probably just making random noises at each other because they were learning from each other and neither of them had a concept of language or speech.
That's slightly assured me. But I just one last question on this. I don't want to doommonger at all, but I've asked a few experts in robotics this in the past, the age-old question. What if, I mean, you mentioned ethics earlier. Yeah. What happens if we make robots that are so smart that one day they might take over the world? And usually the answer I get is one of two things. It's either... If we're making robots to be almost perfect humans, they would realise that maybe war and domination isn't the smart thing to do. That's one answer I get. Or as long as we always know where the off switch, then that's fine. What, as one of the UK's leading experts on robotics, Dr. James Law, what do you say about this?
So my personal feeling is but we simply don't know. there are very good arguments both sides of the debate, and I think we just simply don't know enough, which is why we need to put more effort into trying to understand how these things could develop and ensure that they do develop in the right and the beneficial ways. And that's not just about the research that we do. It's about how we legislate over robots, how we produce standards for robots, and how we monitor the research and development activities that are going on to ensure that people are making robots for good.
It's a good answer. It's not enough to stop me being worried. Now, listen, the other day you helped launch the school robot competition. It's all to do with space this year, James. Can you tell us more?
Yes. So space and robotics are obviously two quite exciting areas. And at the moment in the UK, we have been doing a lot of activities around robots for what we call challenging and hazardous environments. So the types of environments where people don't really want to go or where it's dangerous for people to go. So in space, for example, is one, but inside nuclear reactors and cleaning up contaminated nuclear waste, but also out in the depths of the oceans or perhaps deep underground. So places where people aren't really well suited, but where robots could have a real impact. And so we've got a wide variety of research on these robots for challenging environments at the moment, and space is just one of those. So what we're keen to do is to get students from around the country interested in robotics, show them what we're doing, get them to think about how robots can be used and how robots might be used in the future, because they're going to continue to develop. And it's key that kind of the next generation are prepared to work with robots. They know about robots and they know how to use them.
And to enter, to design the space robot, you have to use an app that you guys have specially created for this. What's the app like? Tell us about how we would function with that.
Okay, yeah. So the app it's a really really exciting app that's been developed by Twinkle, one of our partners on the competition, and it's an augmented reality app. So you can download it onto your phone, you can download it onto your tablet. It's called Twinkle Robotics, and effectively it allows you to build up a robot. Different designs from different modules and program them to go out and explore a Martian surface. And within the app, we give the students using it a number of different challenges, kind of roughly based on scientific missions to Mars, and ask you to design a robot to complete those different challenges. And it's really about going, having a go, building robots, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work, and refining them, just like we do in research.
So if you're interested in robotics and you want to help us explore places where humans don't want to go, so maybe we could send robots, look this up online. The website's quite long and fangled, so if you just Google or search school robot competition, it's the first one that comes up, school robot competition, and it explains everything you need to know there. Listen, Dr. James, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Now for this week's Dangerous Dan, we are headed back 70 million years to have a look at possibly the greatest named dinosaur ever. Look out, here's the Gigantoraptor. I love saying it like that, Gigantoraptor. It looks a little bit like a massive ostrich, really. Through fossils discovered in 2005, scientists think they've worked out that it was a massive flightless bird, like a huge velociraptor, possibly with feathers attached to its arm, almost like small wings. Now, most dinosaurs of this kind, they're about the size of a peacock, but the Gigantoraptor lived up to its name. It had been, like, fully stretched out, and it had hit the gym as well, almost. It measured 26 feet across. They think it roamed across the Gobi Desert area, which is in Asia. It had sharp claws, a piercing beak. Scientists think that it might have been omnivorous too, meaning that it would eat anything. It could get its feathery claws into so much, it would just tuck right in. Now, it wasn't the most deadly creature of all the dinosaurs that we've met before. Not the most terrifying either, but what a name! I mean, come on! You'd be frightened just of what it's called, wouldn't you? One more time, let's hear it for the Gigantoraptor. Right, let's get some answers to some of your geekiest gadget questions. This is one of our faves on the show. Her name is Technomum.
Techno Mum's Tech Trivia with the Institution of Engineering Technology.
Welcome back to Tech Trivia, the game show that tests the technical talents of our tremendous contestants. And playing this week, it's Techno Mum.
Hi, I can't believe I'm still here.
Well, you've played the course so far, but can you keep it up? Let's find out and spin the wheel. And today's category is durability. Your time starts now. Your first question is in two parts. What is durability and why is it important in technology?
Durability is about how well something will last. Engineers need their products to be durable because those products have a job to do and they have to be able to do it without breaking. And that's super important where safety is involved, like medical implants that help keep people alive, and where it's hard to get replacements or repairs, like in space or in the middle of the oceans. That said, even everyday items need to be durable because it can be expensive, not to mention annoying, to have to keep buying replacements or get things repaired. As well as choosing the materials and design carefully, another way that things can be made to last is by future-proofing them. This means making sure they're using new technologies which are expected to be around for a while or can easily be upgraded.
Next question. What's a career where you'd be thinking about durability?
Well, what about a console games tester? Did you know that there are people who are paid to test every part of them? Engineers call the area quality assurance. Some will check the game itself to check for bugs, but others will test the consoles to make sure they can stand up to hours of play. Sometimes machines are used to press the buttons thousands of times because you get a pretty sore finger doing that yourself.
Nice answer. And last question. Name a cool innovation which helps products to be durable.
Well, graphene is pretty amazing. It's a very new material which is created in a laboratory. Made from carbon that's only one atom thick, it's the strongest material in the world. It's incredibly thin and flexible, but unbelievably tough. Engineers are excited about this stuff because it will help make simple items very durable indeed. For example, at the moment, touchscreens on mobile phones and tablets use glass, and we all know how easily they can crack and shatter and how annoying that is. Graphene could be used with plastic to make screens that won't break.
Well, your winning streak shows no sign of being broken. You're through to the next round, Techno Mum.
Great, you could say I'm almost as durable as graphene.
Techno Mum's Tech Trivia with the Institution of Engineering Technology. Find out more at funkidslive.com/tech-trivia.
It's time to get this week's Science in the News. Now, a few years ago, we chatted about the InSight Lander. It's a NASA probe. It's on Mars to detect Mars quakes, like our earthquakes, only they're on the red planet. And it's done a good job. It's detected 450 significant seismic events since it's landed. Now, they're not huge, but they do happen quite often. Actually, scientists think they happen about as often as they do here on Earth. So that links our two planets. Also, some sad news. Pioneering NASA mathematician Katherine Johnson passed away a few days ago, aged 101. She was hugely important in the early space missions, using her extraordinary math skills to calculate rocket trajectories and Earth's orbit to get astronauts in the air. She actually calculated the trajectory and the path for the flight of the very first American in space, Alan Shepard. And finally, we got a bit of a random one to end, because it turns out red squirrels sniff out danger better than the grey ones. Scientists from Queen's University, Belfast, discovered that although the pine marten creature preys on both species, the grey squirrel are much more vulnerable to attack. They think it's because the red ones are more aware, more vigilant, and they're much better at getting away. Very quickly, before we finish this week's Science Weekly, I need your help if you love trains. I've got a quick question, if that's you. Can you please send me in some questions all about trains? You know, at the start of the show, I answer your science questions that you've left over on the Apple Podcast Store. Well, in a few weeks' time, we've got a train special happening on the show where I am going out and about exploring a real-life steam train building yard. And I'm going to chat to some experts along the way. So I'd love your steam train or any just regular train questions that I can ask them. Okay, so if there's anything about about trains, how they're powered, how they work, how the lines work maybe, that you've always wanted to know, please do leave those as a review over on the Apple Podcast Store, and that'll really help me out when I put the episode together. It's happening in a few weeks' time. While you're on the Apple Podcast Store, by the way, it's one of the best places that you can hear all of our science series. You've heard some today. We've got loads more on there. You can also catch them on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids, we're a children's radio station from the UK. As always, you can listen to us on your DAB digital radio, on that Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com.